This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Idstey in Washington, filling in for Neil Conan. 6 years ago today, more than 3,000 Americans were killed in the fiery attacks of 9/11. Those who died at the World Trade Center, at the Pentagon, and in a broad field in Pennsylvania have been called by some the first casualties in the war on terror. The U.S. responded by attacking al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan. Then the Bush administration led the country into what has become a controversial war in Iraq. More than 5,000 American troops and civilian contractors have died there. All those who have died have borne the burden and made the ultimate sacrifice. Today, we're asking what kinds of sacrifices are being made as this global conflict continues. Life and limb, of course, but what else? Individual rights, community cohesion. What sacrifices are you making? We'd like to hear your perspective as a soldier, a farmer, an executive, a New Yorker, a Californian, or a Texan. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can also comment on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we begin with Mark Shields. He's a syndicated columnist and political analyst for PBS's The NewsHour. He joins us in Studio 3A. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Mark.
Thank you, John.
Mark, you've written about the notion of shared sacrifice in the face of war. Are we as a nation sharing sacrifice for the current wars abroad, do you think?
Not at all. It's a war in which all the sacrifice, all the suffering, has been borne by the less than 1% of Americans who volunteered to serve their country and their loved ones. For the rest of us, the sacrifice is the longest war in American history, John, that the United States has fought without a draft and with three major tax cuts. We're not even asked to pay for this war. It stands in stark, dramatic, and really quite an appealing contrast to America's record in the past.
So what would a shared sacrifice entail today, do you think?
Well, give an example of World War II. And the president has compared this struggle to that, the struggle we're currently involved in. In that war, the president of the United States' four sons all served, fought in combat, and were decorated for bravery. The president's closest assistant, Harry Hopkins' 19-year-old son Stephen, was killed as a Marine in the Pacific, as was the governor of Massachusetts, Leverett Saltonstall's son Peter, as was the governor of New York's son as well, Herbert Lehman's son. And all the way across the board, it was a sacrifice borne by not only people of all status and stations, but all citizens. We raised 40% of all the vegetables and fruits in this country during the war by victory gardens that civilians organized in their own neighborhoods and their own backyards. We collected millions of tons of steel for the war effort and paper as well. We went without meat and cigarettes and liquor. There was a sense of collective sacrifice. War does demand equality of sacrifice. And in the great words of George Wilson, a marvelous military journalist, long time of the Washington Post, now in the National Journal, wrote a great book called The Mud Soldier about the American infantryman. And in it, he quoted Colonel Steve Siegfried, who was a combat colonel, company commander in Vietnam. And he said, the one lasting lesson of the thousands that was allegedly learned from that war has to be that an army does not fight a war, a country fights a war. And if a country isn't willing to fight a war, it should never send an army.
Let's take your two points there one at a time. One issue about the people who serve is that there's not a draft right now.
That's right.
For this war. So the president's daughters are not going to be drafted. Mm-hmm. Is that a change that's made a difference, do you think?
I think it's made a profound difference in the country. When we were debating in October 2002, I covered that debate on Capitol Hill to go to war, to give the president the authority. And my assistant at the time, a woman named Diana Andrusia, and I called all 535 congressional offices. And we asked just one question. does the member of Congress or the senator have a son or daughter, a brother or sister in the enlisted ranks of the United States military? And of the 535, exactly one, Senator Tim Johnson, a Democrat of South Dakota, had a son, Brooks Johnson, in the 101st Airborne, where he's a sergeant. Now, we've reached the point where those at power, in power, are totally divorced from those at peril and those we put at peril. There is no, there is no universal experience anymore. And I think it's made a profound difference. I think it's a lot easier to go to war and to talk in a swagger, with a braggadocio about let's go in and bring them on or whatever else, if you don't have any skin in that game, if you don't have any personal involvement and commitment to it.
Let me ask you about this one other point that you make, that people were growing victory gardens and that sort of thing. Women were lining up to give hand over their nylons.
That's right.
I mean, is that really something that we can compare to our country right now? Because we're such a powerful economic nation now, and these sacrifices aren't really demanded, are they?
They aren't demanded, but it is a measure of total commitment on the part of a people. And it comes back to that. I mean, is all the fighting, is all the suffering to be borne only by those in uniform, those who have volunteered to serve their country and defend their country? And others, the rest of us, should just snap off a smart salute and say, thanks for that tax cut. Could we have it extended? Could we have it a little bit larger? My hedge fund is in danger of being taxed at an ordinary rate, that the same rate paid by a school teacher or a police officer. That's terrifying. My goodness. Oh, we're at war. I didn't know that.
We want you to join this conversation, too. Give us a call at 800-989-8255. And let's go to Arlington, Virginia, and talk to Brian, who's on the line. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how you doing today?
I see that you're a reservist.
Yes, I'm a reserve officer on active duty right now.
Uh-huh. And have you been to Iraq?
Not to Iraq, but I've done two tours in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. And what views do you have on this notion of sacrifice and shared sacrifice?
It's a mixed blessing. Those of us in the military, we've volunteered to serve. We've answered the call because for a myriad of reasons. And what we find, what my peers and I find disconcerting at times, is best reflected in what Frank Schaefer, the author and columnist, has pointed out, and as the last speaker pointed out, is the disconnect between our society, specifically our leaders, and those in the military. Outside of very small circles, nobody has any contact with anybody in the military. Very few people have contact with the sacrifices my peers are making on a daily basis in Iraq and Afghanistan and the rest of the world.
And do you resent that? Is that something that bothers you?
I don't resent it as much as I just find it disconcerting that, I don't know, it's tough to put into words.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I can't resent it, or I don't resent it because, again, it's a choice that I made. But it's just an interesting dynamic that, as the last speaker pointed out, one member of Congress has a son in the enlisted ranks of the military.
Mm-hmm.
Many people in the United States don't have any contact whatsoever with those in the military, except unless you're live in the Washington, D.C. area, or you live on a place that has a military base close by.
Thanks for your comment, Brian.
All right.
John, I should amend the point, and since the war began, both the sons of Virginia Senator Jim Webb and Arizona Senator John McCain
are now in
one
the
a
war.
Democrat, yeah. Enlisted Marines who served in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring in the other guest that we have here with us in Studio 3A, Patrick Campbell. He is president of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. He's is a veteran of the war in Iraq, I believe.
Yes, I served in Iraq in 2004, 2005.
And what did you feel about what our caller Brian was saying just then?
I mean, he is expressing the opinions of a lot of our members. I mean, you have our service members are out to war, America's out at Starbucks, and when you come home and you're thinking about, you want to start telling stories about the things that you saw while you're over there. People are talking about whether or not their BlackBerry is working, or whether or not Lindsay Lohan's going to jail or not. And these conversations stand in stark contrast to the experiences and the feelings that a lot of us are having. Mm-hmm. Now, I will say this: when I was in Iraq, I had a blog, and I sent out an email saying I need help. I'm constantly interacting with the local Iraqis, and I need things to give out. And to be honest with you, the response was overwhelming. I had my own, in the headquarters, I had 1st Platoon, 2nd Platoon, 3rd Platoon in Campbell. I was getting 2 to 3 boxes a day. I'd spent 3 or 4 hours a day blowing up soccer balls just so I could give them out. I mean, when people ask for sacrifice, this country is ready. The problem is we haven't asked this country to make these sacrifices. Mm-hmm. And I think that early on, we were afraid to ask because they wouldn't support the war as much. That's completely separate. People understand instinctually that these warriors need our help back home. They just have no idea where to focus their energies.
Yeah, and what would you ask for now? What kind of sacrifice should there be from the folks back home?
I mean, I think it's taking care of the warriors when they get home. I mean, right now in Congress, we're debating about a budget for the Department of Veterans Affairs. And for the last couple years, it's been underfunded by even $5 billion. And now for the first time, we're actually getting the amount of money that all the veterans organizations have said, this is what we need. Just today, I was walking around meetings with World War II veterans, going into these offices and saying, these guys, when they get home, in World War II, when you came home, we paid for school. Now you get home, you get some money. I sat in an office with a World War II veteran. He said, when I got back, I was able to fund 3 degrees with my money, and I'm taking out tons of loans. Mm-hmm. And so, creating benefits, making sure everyone gets psychological counseling and making sure that all of school is paid for when they get home.
Mark Shields, is that enough, though? I mean, that's so... Actually, we're going to have to take a station break before I ask you this question, but I'll ask you if that's enough in just a moment. We're talking about the sacrifice and Iraq War. Not everybody is giving evenly. You can reach us at 1-800-989-TALK or send us an email at talk@npr.org. I'm John Idsty. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Idsty in Washington. Previous wars have demanded sacrifice, a draft, a tax increase, and elbow grease, Rosie the Riveter style. But who and what's getting sacrificed now in Iraq? A little later, we'll talk about how you're marking the 6th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Send us your emails now at Talk of the Nation or at talk@npr.org. My guests are Mark Shields. He's a political analyst for PBS's Political Analysis on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, and Iraq veteran Patrick Campbell. He's the president of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. And, of course, you're invited to join this discussion. What kinds of sacrifices are being made as the conflict continues in Iraq? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address again, talk@npr.org. You can also read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. And Mark, I wanted to ask you, is supporting veterans' benefits enough? I mean, pay your taxes and call your congressman and support. That doesn't seem like a kind of a visceral response to this in a way.
Well, I think the veteran comes back, as Patrick spelled out so well, with certain needs that are currently going unmet. I mean, that seems the minimum we could do collectively as a people is to address that, to welcome the warrior back, to provide not simply for the widow and the orphan, but for the warrior returning. To allow for that time. I mean, you have to understand this. The people who are serving there are not, if they're not career and they're doing a tour of duty, they're not advancing as an investment banker. They're not getting that graduate degree or moving up the corporate ladder. And so somehow we've got to compensate for that time and that sacrifice they have made. I think... That's a minimum beginning.
Mm-hmm. Any other ideas, though? Any other ideas? I mean, Victory Gardens don't make sense.
Well, no, I mean, I think that, you know, we certainly could start and could have started a lot earlier on gasoline before it became a market factor. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would have been an area of absolute sacrifice involved, universal sacrifice. Mm-hmm. It has to be universal. You began this broadcast with a tape of a statement of Charlie Moskos, who, for those who don't know him, is the premier American military sociologist, a former GI himself, drafted out of Princeton. Charlie said, this is a quote of his that's always, I've always repeated because I think it makes so much sense. Only when the privileged classes perform military service, only when elite youth are on the firing line, does the country define the cause as worth young people's blood, and do war losses become acceptable. The answer to what constitutes vital national interest is found not so much on the cause itself, but in who is willing to die for that cause.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to some emails. Here's a point that you were making, Mark. This is from, let's see if I can find out where it's from. Well, anyway, our writer says, thank you for the show. Everyone is happy to buy a yellow ribbon magnet for their SUVs, but no one wants to make changes to their lives. I'm happy living close to work and riding my bike to work. In fact, I've given up car ownership. Please, everyone, make some changes. I want my friends home. Another comment here from Wally Mattel, and he says, the burden of wars are not shared equally, so how about a war surtax, say $2,000 every year we're at war, less than a cafe latte and a roll per day. Proceeds would fund war operations, logistics, and prepaid quality veterans care for the next 50 years. Tax would be levied equally on all adults, rich, poor, seniors, young adults, citizens, immigrants, everyone except families of those serving in our armed forces. It's a small price to pay compared to the sacrifice of military families, and it might unify us as a nation at war. That's from Wally in Reno, Nevada. Let's go to the phones now. Another caller, this one from Modesto, California. Bill, you're on the air. Got a comment?
Hello, John, and hello, Mark.
Hello, Bill.
I would like to comment. I would like to say, tell you the reason why I refuse to voluntarily support this war. It is unjust. There was never a reason for us to go to war against Iraq. The people of Iraq never attacked us. They never threatened us. And I have 8 grandchildren, and I refuse to allow any of them to participate in the military as long as we pursue this insane policy of declaring war on non-threatening third and fourth world countries.
So can I ask you, does that absolve you, Bill, of any sacrifice? Does it mean since you oppose the war that you shouldn't in some way sacrifice to support veterans or
my sacrifice is such that I am doing all that I can to proclaim the right way of doing things. In other words, to change the hearts and the minds of Americans themselves to not do this sort of nonsense that we've got ourselves into, mm-hmm. to not follow the policies of the Bush administration.
Patrick Kramer, any comment on what Bill has to say?
I mean, I had a very unique experience. When I came home from Iraq, I flew through Dallas, and you know, you get into Dallas, and there are thousands of people waiting for you. But I'm actually from Los Angeles, and when I flew into Los Angeles, I showed up in my uniform, and everyone was kind of looking at me cross-eyed. And I remember thinking how much I would wish the people who were there would separate the war from the warrior. And I remember the first restaurant I went into, the server came up to me and said, I just want you to know that I don't support the war, but I support you. And I said, that's exactly it. That's the emotion, is that, you know, I volunteered to serve in Iraq. I'm a medic. My job was to save lives. And I have no desire to kill anyone. I have no desire to fight in wars we don't need to be in. But you know what? I'm serving this country the best way I know how. And we don't, the wars choose the warriors. The warriors don't choose their wars.
One sacrifice many Americans were all making isn't just in the conflicts abroad, but in the civil liberties of people across the country. Joining us now is Zachariah Muhammad Reed. He's a firefighter in Toledo, Ohio, and a veteran of the first Gulf War. He is also one of the many Muslim Americans whose names have popped up on watch lists, and he joins us from his home in Toledo. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you've been detained at the U.S.-Canadian border in the name of national security. Is that a big sacrifice for you?
Well, it is a big sacrifice for me. It's even a bigger sacrifice for my wife and two young children who are forced to endure the four-hour trips across the border as well. We feel it's a very large sacrifice, considering that I've served my country and spent 20 years in the Air National Guard, and I'm a firefighter that puts his life on the line, supposedly, every day I go to work.
And why are you being stopped? What exactly is it?
Well, it's interesting because I don't get any information at all on this topic. I'm not allowed to know why I'm being stopped. And they haven't officially told me I'm on a watch list at all. The only thing I have been told is that I will be stopped every time I come across the border. There's something wrong with my name, and I've been interrogated for an average of 4 hours each time I come back into my homeland.
Hmm. What do you think about Americans who feel that as long as authorities get the job done and keep us secure, you know, so what if a few people have to wait a couple hours at the border?
Yeah, I think that's the general impression and of most Americans here is that if that's what it takes. But it's a tragedy that the American population is willing to hand over the civil liberties that our nation's heroes have bled and died for this perceived comfort at home, when in reality it's their civil liberties that they're giving up as well. Mm-hmm. And that sooner or later they're going to be on the chopping block. So it may be Islam today, but it very well might be something that they're tied closely to tomorrow.
Mark Shields, you have a comment?
Zachariah, thank you, as I should have thanked Patrick earlier for his service. In Patrick's case, there's nobody who sees war and all its horror more personally and proximately than do medics. But in Zachariah's case, thank you for your service, first of all, in the first Persian Gulf War. Secondly, as a firefighter, member of perhaps the most admired and cherished profession in the country, dating from that terrible day 6 years ago in particular. But I think the point he makes is that made by Pastor Bonhoeffer, that first they came after those who didn't look like us, and we said nothing, and, you know, who's next? I mean, I think that is a problem. I did want to say one word about the caller from Fresno, Bill, who, if in fact we did have universal national service for all Americans, for example, in 1958, 72% of all American males were either in the military or had served in the military. We would have had a far more thoughtful, sensible, realistic, and I think enlightened debate on going to war. It was a terrible debate about going to war because, quite frankly, patriotism has been redefined in the current environment. It's no longer a willingness to sacrifice for the common good, to put your life at risk for the safety and well-being of your country, as much as it is the uncritical, enthusiastic endorsement of the invasion of a third world country, agreed upon unpleasant country, as long as there's no personal stake of mine. I'm for escalation without personal participation, becomes the slogan. And it's a moral indictment of a people who do not respect those warriors' service and what they have done. It was Senator Max Cleland who left three limbs on the battlefields of Vietnam, who said it best. He said, I hope someday people look back and say, bad war, good warrior.
Mm-hmm.
And that ought to be the distinction understood.
If I may say something.
Sure.
It is definitely an issue right now that everybody's talking about, whether there needs to be somebody forced to join the military, a draft, and these types of things, volunteer army. And I think what gets missed from the conversation many times is the effects of that our wars that we decide to conduct is having worldwide. I mean, very few times are we talking about the Iraqi element in all this. Suddenly, the war that we've instituted, that we've tried to get support for all over the world, has destroyed an entire country. And now it's the Iraqis' problem. Suddenly, it's the Iraqis' problem. Let them handle it. You know, we need to bail on these people because it's their problem. Suddenly, it's as if they asked us to come there and destroy their country for them.
Mr. Reed, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Zachariah Muhammad Reed is a firefighter in Toledo, Ohio, and a veteran of the First Gulf War. He's been talking to us from his home in Toledo. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
That was a great point.
Patrick Campbell, I want to ask you to tell us a little bit more about the sacrifices that military personnel and their family make. I mean, certainly there are lives and limbs that are lost, but there's more than sort of makes the headlines every day.
When I first went into the vet center, which is a place where soldiers who come home can go and talk about the issues that they're facing, my counselor said, no one goes to war and comes home the same person. And that was my lesson, that, you know, everyone leaves something on the battlefield. Whether or not it's a limb, they leave some part of their heart back there. And, they're saying one-third of soldiers who are coming home from Iraq and one-ninth of soldiers from Afghanistan are having some sort of mental health problems. Post-traumatic stress disorder, readjustment issues. I know myself, I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. And, you know, it's not to say that I regret my choice. Going to Iraq, I volunteered, I begged to go to Iraq, and it's the best decision I ever made. And I'd be willing to go back if I get sent. But I came home broke. And a lot of these guys, they're coming home and their families don't know what to do with these soldiers. I mean, they say the toughest job in the military is to be a military spouse, because you're watching the news 24/7. You never know when that knock on the door is going to be someone saying, your husband, your wife has been killed. And, you know, the thing I'm most scared about going back is not being blown up, is not being kidnapped, is not being injured. It's the idea that I have to give up another year of my life where I'm away from my family and my friends, and I can never get that back. And many soldiers are facing those challenges.
We have an email here from a mother of a fallen soldier. She writes, my son, Sergeant Sherwood Baker, was killed in Iraq on April 26, 2004. Since his death, I have been speaking out about this war, and one of the points I try to make over and over is that the war belongs to all Americans, and the people who are lost and maimed belong to all of us, too. It is way too easy for people to ignore the war and the death. I speak to groups frequently, I speak frequently to groups, and I ask these questions. How much more tax are you willing to pay for the war? And my most serious question, if there were 3,774 children of privilege dead in Iraq, how much longer do you think this war would go on? This is an important show today. Thanks for having it on. Thank you for your email. And let's go to caller. A caller in Hampton Roads, Virginia. Heather, you're on the air. You have a comment?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a military spouse whose husband has 21 years of service in the Army, and he's got both T-shirts, the Afghanistan tour T-shirt and the Iraq tour T-shirt, and we sometimes are, you know, riddled with guilt and relief that he's only had to do one tour. And as a spouse, I would ask people to stop and think for a moment. I have a friend who's also a military spouse, and in her young marriage of 4 years, her husband has been gone for 3 of those 4 years. He has a Purple Heart from a traumatic brain injury, from an IED, a roadside bomb, and she's expecting their first child, and they're deploying him again for 15 months, 4 tours of duty. I would ask people to stop and think, to be empathetic, and think about the burdens placed on military family. And we do it willingly. You know, our husbands and our wives raise their hands to serve in a volunteer army. But it is an unfair burden. And our soldiers are instruments of policy. They don't get to pick and choose where they go, what they support, what they don't support. They are instruments of policy. And where they're ordered to go, they go.
Thank you very much, Heather. And thanks to you, Patrick Campbell, President of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and to Mark Shields, syndicated columnist and political analyst for PBS's The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer.